network file system. Our speaker today has works in the area of high performance computing for silicon graphics. Was called silicon graphics, called SGI now. So I'll hand you over. He's going to talk about performance improvements to NFS, etc., on systems with large numbers of cores, large numbers of processors, etc. I'll hand you over to Greg Banks from SGI. By the way, just one more thing. Can everybody, if they've got any questions, just make a note of it, and we'll get questions at the end. That's okay. Thanks.
Well, good morning, everybody. Slight correction. I don't work in high-performance computing. I know nothing about high-performance computing. I work in file-serving technologies. That's my fault for not briefing him properly. I'm sorry about that. Okay, brief overview of the talk. It's going to be a brief introduction. I'm going to talk about how NFS works, which will be probably quite boring for those of you who aren't NFS hackers, and quite thin for those of you who are. Performance factors that I explored and dealt with, some performance results that I got, and some entertaining fantasies about future work. SGI. Some of you remember when the G stood for something? These days, what we mostly make is honking great compute servers, and more recently, honking great compute clusters, as in little toy Linux boxes and lots of them. We also do storage hardware, and we don't tell people about this anywhere near hard enough. And we make storage software, and in particular, we make a NAS server product, which has NAS server software on it, and that's what I do, and that's why I'm talking about it. What's NAS? NAS is network attached storage. And what that means is your data is on a RAID array, and that RAID array is attached to a special purpose machine, which is not a general purpose computer, even though it's derived from one. And it's the data goes out to your machine across a network interface. And that means you have a file sharing protocol involved. Or more likely, you have a bunch of different file sharing protocols involved. Those of you in the know will probably tell me iCapacity is not a file sharing protocol. Thank you for that. I understand that. Now, there's a bunch of them here. I mentioned SIFS first because everybody knows about it. And NFS. NFS is what I work on. Now, one of the things that we do a lot of with NFS, because we have a lot of customers who are high-performance computing people, is we use NFS as a storage mechanism for shared storage for compute clusters. And that happens a lot because NFS is freely available, which means you don't have to futz around on the nodes of your compute cluster. I'm sorry, is the audio dropping out or is it just me? The administration of NFS is kind of known. You can just buy books, you can Google it. There's nothing weird about it. There's no inherent node limit in NFS, which there is in a lot of distributed file systems. And it's also a lot simpler. This is both a good and bad thing, but it's a lot simpler than things like Lustre and the clustered file system that SGI sells, which is called SIXFS. Compute cluster. They look roughly like this. You have a lot of boxes. We've seen ones 2,000, we've seen 7,000. A lot of people these days are building small ones, only 200 nodes. And they're most frequently made up of Linux clients, 2.4 or 2.6. They tend to lag a little bit behind what everybody else uses because when you have to upgrade 2,000 boxes, you think about it real hard. Typically, there is a low bandwidth or IOPS requirement on each node. And so, for example, a single gigabit Ethernet NIC is quite adequate. This is good because they're cheap. The server that serves the storage, because there's such a large fan out between the server and the clients, the server has a very large aggregate bandwidth or IOPS requirement. And it will typically have a bunch of gigabit Ethernet NICs or even more interesting technologies. So, for example, we sell a box which has 8 NICs on it. Actually, if you bought a box next week, you'd get 12 NICs. and we can build bigger ones. A global namespace is a very highly desirable feature. So the one thing people hate doing is modifying their applications in order to know that if you want to get file X, you have to go on file system slash foo, and if you want file Y, you have to go on file system slash bar. That's a pain. So people like to have this idea of like a global file system, global namespace. Sometimes, but not often, a single file system, but usually a small number of file systems, where the file systems, if there's many of them, they're chosen by some semantics other than, oh, well, we need the performance, so we have to ship that file around. Ethernet bonding, or other tricks like round-robin DNS, are commonly used to provide a single hostname for the server. SGI's NAS server. So our approach is, because we like honking big things, is to build a honking big box. Nice thing about this is the global namespace happens more or less trivially. It's one box. It's global. Didn't have to think about it. One of the features of our architecture is that you can fit an enormous amount of RAM in it. This is great. It means you can share a lot of data, and you have data and metadata caches that you have in one place that all the clients can access, and it's in RAM. And you don't have to go fussing around, like, for instance, many architectures have clusters of smaller machines serving interface. They have to have traffic between them to move that kind of stuff around, and that slows things down. So in short, what we do is, unlike with clusters, unlike with our clients, we scale our performance by scaling up rather than out. The boxes are IA64 Linux machines. They're Altixes. They're a very small Altix. 2-to-8 CPUs, which is in the so small we barely notice region for Altixes. They are replacing the previous generation, which was MIPS Iris. There is actually the machines I'll talk about in a moment have been replaced again by a slightly newer Linux box, but this is what I did the work on. So the box is made up of a series of these bricks, which you stick together like Lego. And the brick is called an A350, and no, that's not an Airbus product. It has a pair of titanium CPUs. It has quite a lot of DIMM slots. I believe you can fit 24 gig on one of these things. They came out before 4 gig DIMMs were common. I'm not sure if you can fit 4 gig DIMMs, and you can probably fit more RAM these days. It has an enormous amount of memory bandwidth inside there. It also has PCIX slots. It has four of them. And we stick some cards in there. We stick a couple of gigabit Ethernet ports and some fiber channel. And the fiber channel goes out and talks to the RAID array that we also sell. Now, when you want to build a bigger server than that, you connect multiple of these bits together, and those circled shove chips, which on the old diagram look like the Northbridge, they're actually a lot fancier. They're actually a Northbridge plus a connection to a network. And that network is Numalink, which is a proprietary interconnect technology that SGI has. And this stack of individual machines, when you reboot, it now becomes one larger machine. Any processor there can go out and grab RAM from any other processors completely silently. It's just a different physical address for RAM happens to be on a different node, and you have to go out across this Numalink network to get it. This is kind of important. When we first ran NFS on one of these, it sucked. Yes, everybody knows it sucks, but on Altix, it sucked really slowly. So the most embarrassing thing was that we had a pair of 1.4 gigahertz titaniums, and they were serving NFS slower than a pair of 800 megahertz MIPS machines. That took a bit of fancy footwork to explain. Some other weird things. You take a 6 CPU machine, you add another one of those bricks, and it's an 8 CPU machine. You've got 33% more CPU to pull and push stuff around, and you get like 12% more throughput. This sucks. More weird stuff. If you have a fixed number of clients, a fixed load, and you add more CPUs than you needed to deal with that load, you get to do less load. That was a little bit surprising. So basically, things don't scale. And in all these cases, things turn out to be CPU limited. So my mission was, should I chose to accept it, and I did, make the Linux NFS server suck faster. Now, a lot of these things are on NUMA. It's really numerization rather than optics. It's very important that you understand that this also is broken on other things that aren't just optics. Here's the before diagram. So the blue line is the theoretical maximum output that you should be able to get by pushing NFS bits as fast as you can over Ethernets. And across the horizontal axis, we have the number of Ethernets. And as you can see, you can never do anywhere near what the Ethernets are capable of pushing. And it gets worse as you add more. Here's a different test. This is a call rate test. This is a test of doing an rsync to an NFS server over a tree, which is actually a Red Hat 9 installation, which is small enough that it lives completely in RAM, so there's no disk involved in this. And what this is measuring is how fast we can bang calls to those Ethernets. And we get a few. There were, I believe, four NICs in this test. So we're doing somewhere less than 10,000 calls a second. Now, on an Ethernet, you can get 70,000 packets a second. So this is bad. Oh, and when that test ends, yeah, machine locks up. I'll have some more to say about that later. By the way, we of course discovered this on a customer site. principles of operation. There's a bunch of daemons that are involved here, and these will all become interesting later. But you have the port mapper, and it's just a little bit of rendezvous daemon. You talk to the port mapper on a known port, and it tells you how to find your RPC programs. In particular, it says, what port's NFS on? Even though it's always on port 2049, you still have to ask. Then you have rpc.mounting. This is very important if you want to mount. It also does a whole bunch of other things. And particularly, it interprets the Etcetera exports. And one of the things that means is that occasionally the kernel has to do what we call an up call. It's not really an up call, to be precise, up to mount D to get it to do things. So mount D is responsible for doing DNS lookups and so forth on behalf of the kernel every now and again. And then you have some NFS threads. If you opened your distro today and start NFS serving on it, you probably have four of them. Here's a hint, that's nowhere near enough. There's a global pool of these things. They have very little state per client. It's very much unlike the SIPS model where you spin off a server for each client. And they know about the client, and there's a lot of state between them. These things are quite different. They compete for incoming RPC calls. So your RPC call from one client can be handled by a number of different servers, depending on how lucky you are. And they also, from time to time, do those up calls. Some data structures. There's the one that matches each UDP or TCP socket. There's a really important one that's basically a global that has a list of the sockets, a list of the threads, and listed threads and sockets in particular states. There is a little cache called IPMAP, which is one of the few things that we know about clients. It basically maps an IP address of a client to some information that we use about it. It's a sparse hash table that's populated on demand when we get the first NFS call from that client. And an RPC service thread, let me just give you a brief description of what it does. It goes to see if there's any sockets in the pending data. If there isn't, it blocks. It's a normal idle condition. It takes a pending socket from that global list, touching that data structure. It reads an RPC call from that socket. It decodes it. It dispatches it. This is where your actual file layout happens. You're waiting for reads or writes. Then you encode the reply again and send it out again, talking to the socket again. All of this will become important later. Cool. Pardon me. Performance factors. What we want to do is scale the workload linearly, or as close as we can manage. So from the smallest model we make, which was at the time two CPUs, up to 8 CPUs. We make an 8 CPU 12 gig EMIC machine now. And we'll build you a larger one, which comes nicely. Many clients. We have to handle 2,000 distinct clients, different IP addresses. Bandwidth, we have to fill those Ethernets. Have them sitting there, we paid money for them, with no bits to flowing through them, that's just bad. And call rate, which is actually quite a different kettle of fish. You need to be able to handle the kind of workloads that do a very high call rate, and there are some of these around. One of our customers is very fond of running a horribly call rate intensive test because they think, oh, it's good to crash NFS servers. We like that. Now, what affects performance? Lock attention. This is your typical multiprocessor Linux thing. You have a spin lock, multiple CPUs want to run in that piece of protected code, and one of them loses and one of them wins, and then the other one spins around wasting time. These are easy to tell because, at least on IA64, when you do an O profile, you see the function IA64 spin lock contention really high in that profile list. And then you get this interesting effect on NUMA, which is true to a lesser degree on other SMPs, that you don't actually need to contend on locks for bad stuff to happen. All you need is to have a global cache line in a data structure or some such that gets written by multiple CPUs and then read by multiple. And the cache line coherency protocol that you're running between your CPUs basically means that if one of those CPUs dirties the cache line, the other one's going to wait and fetch the cache line back again. And if you have two CPUs on two different nodes, for example, so you get the maximum amount of latency in the cache line coherency protocol, both banging on the same global cache line, then that cache line goes backwards and forwards between those nodes, and we call that cache line ping pong. I prefer to call it cache line tennis because I actually like ping pong and hate tennis. And that affects not just locks, but any kind of data structure that you do a write to. Atomic writes, for example, have this problem, even just changing a value in a global data structure. And these are kind of harder to detect because your kernel profile shows a lot of time spent in unobvious places. Oh, I'm dereferencing this pointer. Why did that take 6 microseconds? And we have some neato things on Altix where you can get statistics on the traffic between those nodes, between those shub chips that I showed you earlier. And you, when you get this problem happening, you see a sharp spike in those stats. Now, some specific hotspots that I found and fixed. There is a spin lock that guards that effectively global server-server data structure. Every NFS thread on every CPU fusses with this maybe a dozen times in the lifetime of each core. It's about as hot thing can be. So what I did was I split off all the hot parts, pardon me, all the hot parts of that data structure into other smaller data structures that I call the service pool, allocated one of these pools per node, and attached the threads to these pools. So each thread basically only talks to a single pool. And the sockets end up being shared amongst the pools, but for a number of reasons this proves not to be a problem. The interesting thing here was temporary socket aging. NFS has this clever thing where it decides I'm going to look at all my TCP connections and if any of them hasn't had any activity in 6 minutes, it's bye-bye Mr. Client. This is harmless to clients reconnect, but it just cuts down the number of active TCP connections. That proved a little bit interesting to change around. Some other hot spots. Struct NFS dstats. This is the data structure that a lot of the stuff that comes when you do an NFS stat call, minus S for server, that's where all that stuff comes. It's another global data structure. Some parts of it are protected by a global lock, which gets taken and released twice in the lifetime of each NFS call. And the data that it was actually gathering is what's used to drive the thread list. If you looked at NFSstat, there is an array of numbers which is supposed to tell you how heavily your threads are being used. If anybody can come to me and explain how that works, I'd like to write that up, because the people who wrote it can't explain it adequately to anyone. In fact, the numbers are actually wrong as well. They actually undercount things, so they're useless. So I just chopped that out. Goodbye. Although Neil didn't accept that patch. I've got to figure out some other way to do that. Some other hotspots. The read-ahead parameters. The read-ahead parameters cache is a structure that's used in the NFS server. It caches the struct RAParms that is usually attached to a file descriptor, actually a struct file, when you have a local process. But with NFS, you don't have such a file, you don't have file descriptors. So the read ahead state, which is really important for getting good performance on read, is not there. And so we cache this stuff and match it up. And this means every time we do a read, we have to do a lookup and an insert and a modify of this thing, all of which requires us to take this global spin lock and futz with the cache, futz with the hash table. So what I did was I did some typical hash splitting maneuver. If anyone cares to know, I can explain that later. The hash is now 16 buckets. There is a spin lock for each bucket. And this means that on average, you have much less contention and you can get several CPUs updating this thing in parallel. The duplicate reply cache, yet another global data structure with a global spin lock and a global hash table. This is important for writes. The duplicate reply cache is used for those calls that cannot be safely repeated, non-idempotent calls. So you do things like writes, remove the, make the, things like that, stuff that you can't try again and have the correct result back. There was an interesting discussion in Oleg Kirch's paper at OLS recently. So, more hash splitting. There is the IP map data structure I mentioned earlier. Guess what? Another global spin lock. So it turns out that that result that you got out of that cache for TCP is always the same for a single pipe. Well, that's actually not true. If you remount, no, never mind. So the point is, 99.99% of the time, you get back the same data structure. So I just cached it in the little per socket data structure, which was a very small patch, but it really helped because we don't have to go bang on this global spin lock on every call. Now we only do it on mount, which I'll talk about later. So much for hotspots. Human factors. Again, it's important to emphasize that this also applies to other human machines, although I haven't tested them. The CPU scheduler, and this is true of FLIRS 9, it provides a certain poor locality of reference. It has this idea that, oh, there's a CPU over there, let's migrate the process so we can actually get some CPU time. Effectively ignoring, I'm sure it's actually quite clever inside. But the result I see is NFSDs move around on random CPUs. We lose all the effect of CPU cache. We get to talk across more numalink links to talk to our device driver. And hotspots just get worse. And so when you have a hotspot, the CPU scheduler kicks in and just makes it worse. Yes, thank you for that. So what you really want is that your replies are sent by an NFSD thread, which is living on a CPU, which is very close in terms of numalink hops, to the NIC where that reply is going out on. And you can approximate this pretty well, ignoring things like asymmetrical routing and so forth, by doing it on the CPU with a NIC interrupt swing. And so the solution was leveraging that service pool structure that I added earlier and making the RPC threads node-specific, using the same allowed CPU mask that you can set with TaskSet or ShedSet Affinity. And so you've basically partitioned your NFS threads into multiple separate little boxes one on each NUMA node, and they hardly ever talk to each other anymore. And you only wake up threads for packets arriving on the local NICs. You don't have to, you don't ever accidentally wake a thread on the other side of the machine. Of course, all of this only works when, like in Altix, your CPU, you have bound IRQ semantics. Your IRQs go to fixed CPUs. So IRQ spraying, no. IRQ balance, D, definitely not. And the solution, part of that is to, we have a new little file in the magical NFSD file system which lets us change the number of threads per call, if you like something, I think. What normally happens is you have a single number that's chosen globally, and then we round robin threads that we create amongst all the pools. So, for example, you have a 4 CPU machine. Mount Storm. This is an ugly little problem that we hit. This is what happens when you have hundreds of clients and they all try to mount the same file system in a few seconds. This happens every time you start a job on a compute cluster. And you want parallelism, but Linux stuffs you around in three separate ways. Firstly, that portmap daemon, it's single-threaded. The RPC.mountd, it's single-threaded, and it does a reverse DNS lookup, which is blocking. And then it does a forward DNS lookup, which is blocking. You can work around this by fussing with your local central host file. It's pretty ugly, though. It's not exactly something you put in an appliance. And later on, it gets to respond to an up call from the kernel every time there's you get the first NFS call from each client. So all of this is single-threaded. And then, of course, there is that IP map hash table, which we have to look up for the first time on every mount, and it's also single-threaded. There's a global lock. So the worst case is that mounting your 2,000 clients takes so long that you get TCP timeouts and the clients don't mount. And then the job fails and then we get a nasty call. The solution is fixing the hash problem. It was actually quite simple. There was a hash balancing problem. There was a patch that went around on that. Thank you for that. With that, we managed to mount 2,000 clients. It's not auto-mounted, that's the problem. You have your parallel batch job scheduling system and it says, I'm going to start this job on 4,000 CPUs. And they all say, hey, I need this file system. And they all do this. They all mount the new file systems again. Because that would be too easy. I don't like these things. I just fix the problems. The other part of the solution is multi-threading mounting. This turned out to be really easy because all you have to do is just fork it a few times and everything it does just happens to just work because it just uses local files and it does normal POSIX file control locking. And with that you can get, we run eight mount daemons and we get about a 7.5 times speed up with that. So then you can mount your 2K clients quickly, which you know, when you have 2,000 clients running around for a mount to continue, you know, they, people who run parallel clusters don't like that. Duplicate reply cache. Oh, I could talk about this for days, so maybe I won't. CPU scheduler overhead. Oh, this is what happens when the machine locks up when you feed it too many calls at a time. You get this wonderful little denial of service probability effect. What happens is NFS wakes up a thread for every call. And when you have hundreds of clients, there's more clients than there are threads. And then all the threads, we're on 128 threads because we like lots of threads. All 128 threads are runnable all the time, but only four of them get to the CPU. And so you have these enormous long run queues, a load average of 120. At least in Fuzz 9, the scheduler really didn't like having a load average of 120, and it ate 3 to 4 to 7% of the CPU, which was the last 7% of the CPU. And what happens is that basically you pretty much only run the kernel NFSD threads, which is a problem because while you're still mounting, you need all those user space threads to run every now and again and not every few minutes. Like more than, you know, so what happens is portmapper or mountd gets gets a TCP SYN, and then it sits there for 5 minutes and eventually it returns, because it's, after 5 minutes it's scheduled enough time to actually run accept. And you get TCP timeouts from the client, and the mount process just fails. And so the test the client, the customer was running with, are just adding clients, so there's more and more CPU, he just fell over. Very simple patch. You limit the number of NFSDs that are woken but not yet running on the CPU. It's like a 10-line patch. Why we didn't think of that earlier, I don't know. NFS, oh, who cares about UDP? Write performance. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out why we couldn't write particularly fast. Well, it turned out there was a bug in XFS. This is why it took me such a long time, because I know nothing about XFS. And there was a logic bug in the XFS write-back path, and it was incorrectly interpreting the WBC. Christoph will tell you all about it. And as a result, we got to the point where KUPD was incorrectly locking while holding the ISEM. Well, you can tell how old this presentation is, ISEM, historical. And that locks out the NFSD, who then can't take that lock to write some more data into the page cache for that inode. And as a result, you can move bits from the network to the page cache or from the page cache to the disk, but not at the same time. And you end up basically halving write performance, at least for a small number of files. That was easily fixed by the XFSD, well, I don't pretend to understand how. Tunings. I have an enormous number of pages about stuff we tuned. I could go through this. VM stuff is important. Async export option. Don't try this at home. Bad, evil stuff happens, but not for a few months.
Why are you still using
MFSD first? What? Don't accuse us. No. What async does is turn off the effect of the V3 commit call. The commit call is a V3 thing that says, you know all this data I write to you, it's not on the disk, but I want it to be on the disk, and don't return to me until it's on the disk, which means the client is making the decisions about when to flush the server's page cache to the disk, and it doesn't know when to do that. And the client just basically say, yeah, I've written a megabyte, that's probably enough. It's less than our stripe size. Right. So what async does is turn it off and let the normal VM mechanisms for pushing out dirty data apply. But the problem now is that the client thinks, oh, that data's safe on disk, I'll just delete my copy. Yeah, you don't want that happening to you. There's also a really nasty thing that happens where if the rates of writing stuff out to disk on the server and writing stuff into page cache from the clients differ by enough, you actually can deadlock it out of memory on the server. It probably doesn't happen anymore on Slayers 10, but we managed to hit this on 9. Also, no subtree check. This is really important. It's actually the default now, so maybe I'll skip that. Oh, ARP cache. Yeah. I'd like to talk to Dave in about how clever the ARP cache normal behavior is, but I think I've already lost the argument before I start. Oh, and we discovered that if you feed 2,000 real clients at it, there's not enough room in the ARP cache, so you have to tune it up. And this was actually figured out for us by a very clever customer who realized we were running a Linux box and sent us the command. I'm going to buy that guy a beer one day. Performance results were pretty pictures. So you saw the before picture before. Now it's after, and you see the after picture. We're a lot closer to the theoretical maximum. Actually, there's a bug in the data. When I calculated the data for the blue line, I forgot to do it in megabits. So that line is actually about 5% down. So we're actually a lot better than that graph tells you. Here's the CPU usage. You can see we got a lot better. We're using a lot less of that CPU to move those bits out to the network. Here's that IOPS test again. Notice the tiny little red curve in the corner. That's the thing you saw before. Now we do over 20,000 IOPS per CPU. And the test never locked up. It sort of degraded a bit, the gross throughput degraded as you add more clients, but it only stopped when I got the board running. And here's the CPU usage. You see, beforehand, we would climb pretty much vertically upwards and then overload. Now we just, we travel. And the sum of all this was that we could publish for the first time the spec SFS benchmark results for Optics. It was got to the point of not being embarrassing. some customer history. Customer site W tried this in July 2005. The utter and complete abject failure at actually handling their load was what started this project. They had a mere 200 clients. A year later, we ran a different customer P. They had 10 times the number of clients and handled it like a dream. Just didn't even blink. And now, customer W is trying it again. And I actually got an update on that. We got some good news from them the other day. Sorry? January, it's the year of getting the date wrong. The month of getting the year wrong, you know what I mean. Future work. I really should talk about this at the NFS BOT that's happening on Thursday, 12:30 in Matthew's A. Am I right? Yeah. There's a whole bunch of neato things that we could do. Each of these is an open bug in our internal bug system, by the way. But so read ahead, palms case needs work. We could reduce the number of CPU copies on write. Dynamic thread management, I've been threatening to do that for years. Multi-thread port map turns out to be difficult, probably not worth it. Acknowledgements. Thank you, SGI, for giving me all the cool toys. The patches, everything I've talked about here is kernel and NFS patches. It's all either been submitted or being submitted. And I want to thank all the code reviewers, at least some of them are actually in this room. References, whatever. Oh, ad. We're hiring. Anyone want to come down to Melbourne and work with us on this cool stuff? You know, talk to that guy there at the front. Stand up, Mike. He's the guy who makes the hiring and firing decisions. So. Question. How much time do we have?
We've got about a couple of minutes. I think we can take a couple of quick questions. Hang on, I'll come up.
Did you only use TCP to talk to the clients or UDP also?
Sorry, I can't hear.
Did you only use TCP from the clients or the UDP? Because if they're using TCP and Linux clients, I don't think you should get that money piece like you were saying you're getting. Something must have been wrong.
Please don't use UDP.
Sorry?
NFS over UDP is this horrible historical mistake that should never have happened.
Okay. Okay, I was thinking that, but if you're using TCP from Linux clients, I'm using you usually have Linux clients, right?
Sorry, I can't quite hear you.
I'm assuming you usually have Linux clients for that. Because if they're using TCP to talk to them, then they don't want RP very often because they're only up when they don't make any forward progress.
That's right.
So you shouldn't actually be seeing this up problem you discussed.
That up problem happens during mount. Because during mount, when they're all doing the ARP that comes with this setting up the first connection they've ever seen to the server, and then everybody's ARPing all the time in this lovely little storm of ARPs. And then
why is it a problem during mount if it moves around between interfaces? Because the problem, the thing I'm objecting to is when you turn on this ARP announcement off and you don't get any failover anymore. So if one of your network interfaces dies, then you're dead, at least for the connection that we're on that.
One. Yes. this is one of the problems that we have. Linux has some interesting ideas about ARP. I'm using interesting in the Chinese sense.
No, but actually they need it for failover, you know, like...
We actually don't support failover HA on these boxes yet. That's actually the project we're doing just now. So I guess we're looking at it. And your question about UDP, I did a whole bunch of work that I didn't bother mentioning to fix the horrible performance problems over UDP. But any other questions?
Yeah,
Any other quick questions?
At the back end, I presume all your fiber channel IOs are going, you're using all the bricks for IO there, so which clustered file system are you using at the back end?
There's no clustered file system. It's one machine. It's one single system image. There's no clustering.
Any more? All right. Thank you very much, Greg. That's all for now.